Lecture 11, Sculpture.
Welcome back to our series of lectures on the Hellenistic world. So far, the focus of our lectures has been primarily towards the political history of the Hellenistic age. We've looked at the void created by the death of Alexander the Great, and we've investigated how the major Hellenistic kingdoms came into being. We've also looked a little at the administration and the structure of these Hellenistic kingdoms, ranging from Ptolemaic Egypt to the Seleucid realm, and also including the smaller Attalid kingdom of Asia Minor, and then finally considering the Far Eastern Bactrian Greek kingdoms, which were somewhat anomalous because it was here that we found evidence for what might truly be called a fusion of Greek and local elements in the culture. I want to move away in this next section of lectures from the political history and turn more to topics that we sometimes would call the social history of the age. But what I'm really trying to do is to investigate how the people of the Mediterranean world responded to the enormous changes that we've witnessed, that they've undergone since the period of Alexander's conquests. We now find Greeks living in cities which 100 years earlier were only ideas or names to them, and new cities founded completely from scratch where no Greeks had lived before. And we find the Greeks now living in a world which is dominated by these super powerful kings, men who've become the kings of the Hellenistic world and who are often seen as the great benefactors, and as we're going to see in a lecture later on, are often also portrayed as living gods, saviors, benefactors and do-gooders, dominating the political landscape. In this world, people were confronting a new uncertainty about the future. The old forms and institutions of Greek life were not well adapted to a scale spread across the Hellenistic world. And so we're going to see real changes in the way people live their lives, the way artists respond to the conditions of the world in which they live. Nowhere can this change be better charted than in the sculpture of the age. In later lectures, we'll also look at philosophy and we'll look at literature, but I want to begin this set of lectures with the art of the Hellenistic period and specifically the sculpture of the age, because it's here that we see a dramatic difference between the earlier classical period and the age to come, the Hellenistic period, where human experience will be explored in a whole new way, where the art will be dramatic, where it will be emotional, and in the eyes of some, it will be excessive and gargantuan. It's this art which is sometimes described as Baroque, and it is this emotional art which in the eyes of many critics in the 19th century was excessive and was decadent when compared with the earlier period. Well, before we go right into Hellenistic art, let's stop for a moment and consider what the Greeks had done up until this time in their sculpture. The classical style of sculpture had tended to emphasize repose and calm. Classical sculpture, particularly the statues of gods and goddesses, had really derived from earlier Egyptian canons of sculpture, and I'm sure you've seen Egyptian statues that show frontal figures very stiffly arranged with their feet, one forward and one back, and the arms held closely by their side. The Greeks had taken this style, and in the 6th century had begun to loosen it up somewhat, so that the figures of classical sculpture tend to be somewhat more naturally posed than the Egyptian models they're based on. But the Greek artists of the classical age are usually not exploring emotions or the inner life of the individual. They are not really portraits in the sense that we know them. These are archetypal statues expressing the Olympian calm of the gods. If you consider, for example, the statue at Olympia, one of the pedimental sculptures from the temple there showing the fight between the Lapiths and the Centaurs, in this great furious melee and combat going on, Apollo stands at the center of the scene in the middle of the pediment with his arm extended and his face looking impassively over the action, because he is a god removed from the realm of humans. Our world is chaos and disorder, the Greeks see, but the gods are somewhat beyond that, removed, distant. And so the high point of classical sculpture really comes, to my mind at least, in this so-called severe style, where the face is impassive and immobile and where very little human expression is allowed. Now, in the 4th century, the bridge between the classical period and the Hellenistic age, three masters emerged in the field of sculpture whose careers really allow us to span the shift from classical to Hellenistic. The first of these is Polycletus, and I want to begin with him because it's with Polycletus that we really see, I think, the absolute apogee of classical sculpture. His sculptures tend to be of either gods or young men, athletes, who are the living embodiment of manly excellence. The spear carrier, for example, or as it's known in Greek, the doripheros, or another one, the diadumenos, the athlete who has his hands up and is tying the ribbon around his head. These statues were famous for establishing what in antiquity was referred to as the canon. In other words, this was the way that the male form should be represented in its most ideal style. Now, there were very carefully worked out proportions in this sculpture, so that if you measured the sculpture, you would find that the head would normally be 1/6 the size of the body. Very careful proportions. And not only that, but the stance of the figures also is carefully designed. It becomes canonical. It's the stance that's later borrowed in Renaissance art, the so-called contrapposto stance, where the weight is all on one foot, so that one leg is showing going straight to the ground, while the other, relaxed and easy, is bent at the knee. And as a result of this stance, the hips and the bottom of the rib cage, instead of forming parallel lines, form lines that meet and part at different angles. And this is to impart to the body a more natural style. At the same time, it's still an ideal figuration of the human form. This is the human form represented in sculpture in perfection. And I think it is what classical sculpture has been moving towards. But it raises the question, if you reach perfection, what do you do next in your sculpture? It's all downhill from there. Well, not exactly. What the sculptors of the 4th century and increasingly of the Hellenistic period will do is they will move away from this Olympian calm, this absolute awe-inspiring perfection of the classical ideal, and they will start to explore much more human aspects of our experience through sculpture. The first sculptor who really does this is Scopas, and he's famous for a variety of statues of the gods, but also statues that represent human feelings. One such statue is the one known as Yearning, or pothos. It's another one that you have in your dossier. And this idea of pothos, or yearning, is a favorite theme of the Hellenistic world. In fact, you might recall that when we looked at Alexander's career, that some of the sources for Alexander's campaign constantly refer to his pothos, his desire, his yearning to go to Siwa to visit the Oracle of Amon, or his yearning to take the Rock of Aornos because Heracles had been unable to do it. This notion was caught in stone by Scopas in his statue of yearning, of pothos, because he was trying to find a way of expressing human feelings in stone. And that's a new development. And then the third of the great Hellenistic sculptors is named Lysippus, and he also marks the final bridge really from classical to Hellenistic, because it is Lysippus who is going to give to the world the image of Alexander. Lysippus was a sculptor whose image of Alexander the great king actually saw and admired, and he used it as the preferred portrait, which was then copied and spread throughout the Hellenistic world. The Lysippan image of Alexander would be copied, and it is very distinctive. You've probably seen various versions of it. There are some from Egypt, there are some from Macedonia. But what they share in common is this. The king will always be shown as a young, beardless man. All right, he's likened to, say, the Athenian hero Theseus, who was also beardless, compared to Heracles, who's always a mature man. He will have a rather pouty face. He usually seems to have a little bit of extra fat. And in his expression, he always seems to be turning and looking up to heaven. There's a kind of dreamy look in his eyes, and his mouth is open as if he's in a reverie, as if he's communicating somehow with the gods. And you can always pick it's Alexander because his hair, which is beautifully curled, will also have a little part in the center and the hair will bob up on either side. This is a style that was so distinctive that even in antiquity they recognized it. They called it the Anastole. And it makes him look as if he has sort of a lion's mane around his head or a halo. This image would be very popular and it would be copied throughout the Hellenistic world. It turns up on coins of Alexander, it turns up in engraved gems, and the bust itself is copied numerous times throughout the Hellenistic period so that people could have their own Alexander in their own court or in their own house. Now, what we see in the movement of these three sculptors is a move away from the old classical ideal where the sculpture is not really of an individual but of a type, to a new interest in various forms of human expression, and particularly, thanks to Lysippus, an interest in the great man. Now, it's hardly surprising that the sculptors of the time should be interested in this. Alexander the Great was an example of what Aristotle had talked about, the man of what he called megaloptyche, a great spirit, the man whose soul was so large that he became superhuman in his accomplishments. And of course, to the men and women of the Hellenistic age, they were surrounded by such men, because after Alexander came Ptolemy and Seleucus and Antigonus and Attalus and so forth. And these great kings were the great men, the living embodiment of this principle. And so there are statues of gods and statues of kings created to adorn their new temples and to adorn the palaces of this new Hellenistic world that show this interest in capturing the soul of the great man. Now, to the extent that these sculptors are depicting the kings of the age, that's very understandable. But one of the first really interesting developments, I think, in Hellenistic sculpture is that the artists begin to move beyond the king as great man, and they start looking at a range of other figures who also fit the bill as well. Intellectual heroes, such as Socrates, come to be popularly portrayed in Hellenistic sculpture. Now, Socrates is actually a very ugly type. He's a small, squat man with a little pot belly and a little frog face. So he doesn't conform in any way to a canonical notion of male beauty. But there is something about him, and it's that he is a kind of moral hero. He'd stood up to the Athenians and that he'd been prepared to die for his beliefs, and that in his apology, his defense speech, instead of sniveling and trying to get off scot-free, he'd challenged the Athenians by saying, "You ought to reward me because I've been your moral educator." So this sort of moral heroism turned Socrates into a kind of intellectual hero, and he's widely depicted in the Hellenistic age. As, for example, are other figures such as Demosthenes. Now, it's in some ways an odd choice if you think about it. Demosthenes was the great Athenian orator who had made his reputation, his immortal reputation really, on the fact that he had opposed the Macedonians. And yet all the patrons of this great art were Macedonians descended from the very people who'd been opposed by Demosthenes. And yet Demosthenes represented the high point of Greek oratory. Socrates, the high point of Greek philosophy, along with Plato and Aristotle. We also find many busts of them. Demosthenes, the high point of Greek oratory. And we also find busts and full-length statues of men such as Herodotus and Thucydides. Why? Because they represent the high point of Greek history writing. There's something very interesting going on here. What's happening is that in the Hellenistic age, Greek culture is being packaged. The heroes of Greek culture are being given their own statues, and these are being popularly exported throughout the Greek world and purchased by people, put up in civic squares or in people's own houses. It is as if the people of the Hellenistic age are looking back with nostalgia to the classical period, wanting to have some kind of contact to suggest that they are the continuation of that, in the same way that people today might have a bust of Beethoven on their piano. They may not play like a concert pianist, but they want to suggest that they still are part of that world of classical culture, classical music. Eventually, and this I think is a very interesting development, busts of philosophers would become as common as those of kings. So that if you go to, say, Aphrodisias today, a city in southern Turkey, and a city that flourished in the Hellenistic and then in the Roman period, if you go to the museum there and look at the public statues that have been excavated over the last 30 years, you'll find that there are Roman Caesars and emperors who are being recorded there, but there are also philosophers as well. This is the new development of the age. These philosophers in real life were often advisors of the Hellenistic kings. But I think that the reason that we're finding so many busts of philosophers being made and so many statues of them is that in the Hellenistic view, philosophy is a kind of alternative avenue to power. The Hellenistic kings, of course, represent supreme political power in this earthly realm, but there is another type of power. It's the control over yourself, autarky. If you can banish your appetites so that you no longer really care about this world, so that you are untroubled, you have mastered yourself, and you are, in a sense, the perfect philosopher, and you are, in your own realm, your own Hellenistic king as well. I can't help thinking that philosophers and their popularity represent the flip side of the power of the Hellenistic kings, and that in some way they represent a kind of negative image of kings. That while the kings had to be mollified and respected and treated as benefactors, there were many people whose attitude was, ah, I prefer philosophy. That's one development that we find in the age, and already we're seeing something, I think, more interesting than we found in the classical period, something new and vital and interesting in Hellenistic art. But there's something more that goes on as well. If we've really broken the classical mold, as I think we have after Polycletus, then even the human form itself doesn't always have to be ideal. It means that the artist can begin to look at people as they truly are, rather than as they would like to be. And what we find is that Hellenistic art, therefore, will begin to explore all the different shapes and sizes of the human body. It will explore the poor, the disfigured, the pathetic. Hellenistic art will go to the extremes of human experience in a way that classical art had never done in the period before. And of course, it's exactly this interest in the extremes of human situations that led Hellenistic art to be disparaged in the 19th century as decadent, because it wasn't classical and ideal, because it showed people really warts and all, and often with a lot more than just their warts too. A statue that illustrates this quite well, I think, is the statue of the old fisherman, which we know from a Roman copy. In fact, it was so popular that we have a number of different Roman copies of this. But I think what they all share in common is that they illustrate that the artist in making this figure is not in any way or form trying to idealize the human body. The fisherman that we look at may be stoic, and he may be heroic because he's putting up with the travails of life, but he is not physically beautiful. His body is shown in a cramped posture with his knees bent. His arms are in a rather awkward position with one stuck out on one side. And you can see, if you look at his body, that the skin is sagging on it because he's a very old man. Now, this is absolutely new. He may be morally or stoically heroic, but he's not physically heroic in the Greek sense of that. This is very interesting and very new because, of course, up until now, the Greeks have shown everyone in their sculpture as being heroic, regardless of their real age. Even a statue such as the one we see here, showing Zeus preparing to throw his thunderbolt, shows the god, the father of gods and men. So he's not a 20-year-old, he's more like a 50-year-old, but he has the body of an athlete. The body of a 20-year-old athlete. And this is common in the Greek world of the classical period. But now we're going to start taking the blinkers off and showing old age as it really is. Similarly, and even more dramatically, if you consider the sculpture known as the Boxer, you find that we've got a character here whose face is battered and smashed. He actually looks a little bit like Evander Holyfield, who's going to be fighting soon again. And we see, if you look in profile, you can see his nose has been pushed in. And he is, in some ways, a very moving figure. In some ways, he's even heroic, but not heroic in the earlier Greek sense of the word. Okay? He's heroic in our sense, to our sensibilities, because his body represents through its the position of his hands and the stooping of his head and back, because it suggests a terrible resignation. It's as if the artist has caught him at the moment when the bell rings for the beginning of the new round, and the old man, tired and worn out, says, "Do I have to go out again?" And we know he's going to. He will get up and fight again, even though his body is exhausted. So there is a heroism in that sculpture, I think. It's a heroism of endurance and a heroism of resignation, but it's certainly not heroic in the way that the Greeks had construed physical heroism prior to this time. So there's one other aspect of that sculpture that also bears thinking about, and that is that if you look at it from the front, if you're right in front of the boxer, you can't see much of his face because his face is completely turned away. On the other hand, if you go around to look at his face, you can't see much of his body because his shoulders and arms are blocking you. This sculpture is clearly designed for you to look at from a multitude of angles. It wasn't designed to be put high up on a pediment where you couldn't see it. It wasn't designed to express some Olympian calm of a god, but rather it's of a living man, and it's going to be placed somewhere at a level where you can walk around it and investigate it, looking at the face, looking at the body, marveling at the musculature, and sympathizing with his plight as well. So the whole way that we've been invited in, as it were, to look at this sculpture, I think represents a whole new attitude on the part of the artist, not only to his material, but even also to us, his audience, as we come in to share the experience. In much the same way as in an earlier lecture on Pergamum, I pointed out that as you go up the great altar, you see the figures around you. They're not high up on a temple above you, they're at the sides of the steps, and they tip out onto the steps so that there will be a writhing beast and a figure in torment with his knees right on the step that you're standing on. You are invited into this sculpture. A whole new attitude towards the audience. Similarly, statues such as the well-known statue of the old drunken woman, or also the statue of the Barberini faun, these represent a break from earlier traditions where the emphasis had been on poise and on restrained power. The old woman that we see, the old drunken woman, as you can see, is clutching in her arms an amphora, a drinking jug. And she's on the ground because she can't even stand up now. And she's holding on desperately to this drinking jug as if somebody said, "Come on, old lady, you've had enough. I'm going to take that away from you." It's a very dramatic moment. She's grotesquely hunched over the amphora so that the sculptor must render the body not as something standing upright and erect. There's no canon here of proportions of head to body, but rather it's a compact ball with everything turned in on itself. It's a whole new way of representing the human body and a whole new interest in what humans do. It's a graphic realism. In the case of the Barberini faun, a figure who is reclining in the middle of the day, enjoying a reverie with his hands up behind his head and his legs graphically widely open, the faun is shamelessly provocative in a way that violates all the earlier canons of classical sculpture. Because frankly, with the way his body is reclining and with his legs open, the entire visual emphasis of the sculpture is on his genitals. These are not incidental in the way that a naked male statue before has genitals, but you aren't asked to pay particular attention to it. Rather, this is taking you right to a creature of extraordinary sexuality, and it is inviting you to try to experience that same sexuality as well. So that the sculpture violates all the earlier canons in the same way that another faun's, Nijinsky's, later on would violate the canons of dance, in terms of both theme and technique. It's a very similar situation. So the entire sensibility of the sculpture that I've been talking about is quite different. Previously, Greek sculpture had been either immobile or it had been just on the point of moving. In fact, in the example that we have over here of the Zeus statue that I mentioned a little earlier, Zeus, who is holding his thunderbolt, if you could see his legs, you'd find that one leg shows that he's going forward and the other one is in balance with it. He couldn't actually stand in that position. His body is rocking forward, ready to shoot out his thunderbolt. But what we find now in the Hellenistic age is not just something that is immobile or about to move, but we find writhing movement, such as in the statue of Laocoon. In the case of Laocoon, who has been punished by the gods because he had tried to warn the Trojans that the Trojan horse was a trap and that there were Greeks inside, in this instance, we know from literary accounts, the myth was widely known, that the serpents are sent out by the gods and they capture the man and his sons, coil him up and kill him. We've known about this in mythology, but we don't see it depicted before the Hellenistic period. Whereas now in the Hellenistic period, this becomes a very popular sculpture, it's widely copied, and in it, the great emphasis is on the pain and the anguish felt by this character. The expression on the face of Laocoon, as he knows he's about to die and his sons are about to die, is truly pathetic. So there's an extraordinary movement and a drama in this sculpture that we don't find in earlier classical sculpture. There's a terrible pathos and a drama to it as we're taken into the very center of the action. Similarly, if one considers another well-known Hellenistic sculpture, that of the jockey who is riding on his horse, we find here that there is nothing noble, there is nothing Olympian about this. It's a scene that people could have witnessed if they'd gone to the races, so it's something taken out of daily life. And here we see the little boy sitting on his horse, the horse much too big for him, and he's thrashing it as he turns around to see whether his competitors are catching up to him. As with so many other examples of Greek sculpture of the Hellenistic period, this sculpture is trying to capture a particular moment, a critical moment here, just as he turns away to see whether his opponents are coming. Similarly, in the Laocoon, as the snakes just grab hold of him and now begin to crush him to death. It's the same sort of thing that we find in that well-known mosaic from Naples that I've mentioned on an earlier occasion, the one that shows Alexander defeating Darius, when again the artist's interest is in the moment, that critical moment when history is about to shift and as the Hellenistic world comes into the ascendant as the Persian Empire passes to defeat. Another well-known example of sculpture from the period that in some way sums up most of the tendencies of the age is that of the Farnese Heracles, again known to us from Roman copies. And this Heracles is utterly unlike the Heracles that you may have seen on Greek vases of the classical period. This is not the triumphant Heracles who is defeating the Lernaean Hydra, or who is defeating the Nemean lion. This rather is a Heracles who has accomplished his labors but is exhausted by them. And what we see is a body, yes, of massive musculature, but something almost overgrown, almost on steroids, if you will, and at the same time exhausted by the sheer effort of his labors. So he's a Heracles who is triumphant and heroic, if you like, but it's a triumph and a heroism that is based on endurance and on pain, not on the imminent victory of a god. This is a much more human Heracles than we find in earlier Greek art. There are all sorts of interesting changes going on in the sculpture of this age. Nudity, for example, is another area where we find a very different treatment from earlier. Before, in the classical age, heroes and gods were depicted naked and females were clothed. So that, for example, statues of Athena would show her completely dressed and usually wearing her armor as well. Nudity was something that was for men because athletes exercised naked and gods could be shown naked as well. It was appropriate for them. But now in the Hellenistic age, we begin to get a rather prurient fascination with the nudity of women. So that we get statues of Aphrodite, and often Aphrodite, she's climbing out of her bath. So that she must demurely cover her genitals so that the audience can't see it. And of course, in doing so, she's actually attracting the audience's attention right to that. These sculptures of the Hellenistic age really leave nothing to the imagination. And when one considers who the patrons for this may be, it's no longer just the state, it's private individuals and it's private drinking clubs and religious confederations that are commissioning these. And clearly the artists are responding to the taste of the time, moving away from the grand and the Olympian to something a little bit easier to grab hold of. The last element of Hellenistic sculpture that we have time to mention is an ironic one, and that is that the sculptors of the Hellenistic age were so acutely aware of the classical period and what it had produced that they were called upon sometimes to produce copies of what had been created in the earlier classical age. They produced archaizing statues, not archaic, not from the earlier period itself, but in the style of the earlier period. And there is a whole market in the Hellenistic age for buying these archaizing sculptures so that people can make their house look as if they've got art treasures from 200 years earlier. So what we find is a strange combination of nostalgia, taste, and historical sense combining as the Hellenistic age does something that the Greeks had not done before this. It packages its own glorious past for cultural consumption.